Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show on ESPN. Good to have you with us, gang. Week 7 of the NFL season rolling into view, as is Mr. Jeff Darlington, Esquire, back for another appearance on the show. Cannot wait to get into some of the big games, big matchups this weekend with Jeff, including the biggie, Titans Steelers. Something's got to give. Jeff will break that down and some of the other heavyweight clashes coming your way. But if one guest wasn't enough for you, well, you're in the right place because we're doubling down. Hannah Wilkes of Sky Sports fame, making her season debut on the show. Looking forward to catching up with her about her brand new show on Sky Sports NFL Overtime. And we'll get into some of the big stories of the week with her as well, including Miami's decision to go with Tua and bench Fitz, which hasn't gone exactly down well with Fitzmagic. Lots of other stories we'll get into Hannah with as well, and maybe sneak in one or two picks from the Week 7 slate if we have time. But let's get straight down to business with the brilliant Jeff Darlington. Jeff, good to have you back on the show, man. How's life?
Yeah, man, it's going well. Thanks for having me back on. We have a really good weekend of games this weekend. It feels like things are starting to kind of heat up a little bit.
Big time. There are a couple of crackers that we're going to get into with you. Before we do, though, before we preview some of the big games this weekend, breaking news as we're recording this on Thursday afternoon, Yannick Ngakoue on the move again. Tell us more about this deal.
Well, what's interesting about it is that the Jacksonville Jaguars had traded Ngakoue over to the Vikings, second round pick and a conditional fifth. The Vikings, not much, you know, half a season later, are now trading him to the Ravens, and they're getting a third round pick and a conditional fifth. So they're kind of losing a round with one of their picks. Seems very strange, but the one thing I'd point out here is that he is on a one-year deal. Basically, this was the final year of his contract. So if the Vikings felt like they weren't going to be able to re-sign him, it actually was smart of them to try to get as much as possible. So a decent return, but it does make you question why they did it in the first place. I suppose maybe they just expected maybe a little bit more of a successful season than they're off to right now.
Exactly. I guess that's answered to the most part my follow-up question. Is this the Vikings throwing in the towel on this season then?
I mean, it feels like it to a degree. I mean, I shouldn't say entirely because, again, you're going to have to pay him a pretty massive contract, up $80, $90 million. So if you're not fully convinced on a guy and you can get that kind of return, go for it. So to a degree, it doesn't feel like they're all in, that's for sure. But but that said, I understand the idea of maybe hedging your loss a little bit here.
Yeah, and their loss is the Ravens game, of course. And he's had 5 sacks, incidentally, so far this season. So it's not as if he's been a bust, if that is the conclusion some people are drawing. So interesting news developing. But let's get down to business this weekend specifically. I want to start with the game of the weekend, no doubt about it, the Steelers-Titans. And talk about, first of all, in terms of wider context, the Steelers. When you look at the Ravens, you can apply this to as well, those teams in the NFL that adhere to continuity and build an identity that they maintain through different incarnations. I mean, the Steelers case, they've changed head coaches twice in 51 years. Ridiculous stat. Why don't more teams look at the importance of continuity and look at pretty much every team that continues to succeed in the NFL, Jeff, and realize what the secret is and try and adhere to that themselves?
Well, I mean, I think it's one of those things that's just easier said than done. I mean, if you look at what Mike Tomlin did out of the gates, he was successful immediately. So having continuity is a little bit easier when you have success that goes parallel with it. I think that teams do have sometimes too short of a leash with somebody. You might get rid of them before they have a chance to fully change the culture within an organization. The Steelers definitely do maintain patience with their people, but I would say more importantly, they just pick the right people.
But the Steelers it's a great point you make, and Tomlin's a great example because he did have success early on, but then it hasn't in the last few years necessarily been going to plan. Sure. I mean, he's been a coach that gets criticized a lot, tactically at times in terms of, you know, decision-making, clock management, and criticism thrown at him. And while I don't think he's been on the hot seat per se, he's definitely been criticized in certain quarters, but the Steelers stuck with. That's kind of this is maybe not necessarily a fair comparison, but if the Lions look at someone like Matt Patricia, right? Who is under even more pressure than Tomlin's been in recent years, hasn't won anything. Should the Lions, who've been an organization that have been underperforming for decades, should they be thinking, all right, let's just give him a few more years. Let's build, give him time to build an identity here, as opposed to chopping and changing every 2-3 years because it's a coach coming into a losing culture and
right.
and an environment.
You really want me to get in trouble with Lions fans, don't you, by saying that he deserves a few more years?
Yeah.
Look, I have a tough time saying Matt Patricia deserves a few more years. And I think that the argument there is that he never had success as a head coach. When it comes to Mike Tomlin, you can at least sort of say, we know what he's capable of doing. Mm. And maybe he's had trouble getting back to that sort of level. But, you know, when you kind of analyze some of the things that he had gone through with Ben Roethlisberger's injury, with Le'Veon Bell's contract situation, with Antonio Brown's antics, you start to say, okay, we can understand. Tomlin had success. This is why he didn't. We expect him to get back to it. With Matt Patricia, the resume just isn't there to try to fall back on that. I understand what you're saying in terms of having patience with somebody, allowing them to build an organization. I just think that it's also very difficult when you just have nothing to sort of hang your hat on.
Okay. Well, talk about if Matt Patricia is maybe not projecting as the Lions had hoped. Mike Vrabel absolutely is, as far as the Titans are concerned. And we didn't talk about it much on the show earlier in the week. The genius of the maneuver he pulled when they were playing Houston in week 6, trailing with 3 and change to go. And he put 12 men on the field, so drew the intentional foul. And even if you look back at the footage, Jeff, even some of his players are looking around like, what's going on? Like, coach has made a mistake here. But of course, it was all completely calculated, premeditated, a genius move, a Belichickian move, wasn't it?
Belichickian move, exactly. Very much his you know, the person he played for, and Bill Belichick. And, you know, Vrabel, I actually texted him. I said, that was a pretty genius thing for a dumb jock. You know, like, you almost expect for a big kind of burly meathead linebacker that he's going to be more bronze and less brain when it comes to his coaching maneuvers. But that was a brilliant move, almost taking advantage of a loophole. He had actually done something similar in the previous year against the Patriots and Bill Belichick. So Vrabel proving early on that being a hard-nosed coach, being a guy who people think of him, it's funny because the stereotypes about Vrabel are such that, like, players coach because he was a former player. I don't know that that's the truth, because he's harder on his players than just about any coach out there. And the other side of it is, you know, just going to run the ball down your throat and just beat him with brawn, when instead it's kind of like he's almost this disciplinarian, cerebral guy. It just it's counter to what I think we expect from Vrabel, but the success he's having is actually more because of what I was mentioning.
We talked a bit about them last time, actually, when you were on the show, and on the back of this Houston game, Tennessee 601 yards of offense. Now, I know Derrick Henry had about 47% of get the maths right here.
But the balance there, to have a rusher that goes over 200 and a quarterback who throws more than 350, I think was the first time in NFL history, if not one of the very few.
A few times, right?
When you've had that happen. So, look, it isn't just Derrick Henry. It is massively important that you have such an effective running back. Mm. But I do think that the balance that they've created, you know, it goes back to last year. Ryan Tannehill wasn't necessarily getting all of the credit in the playoffs because people saw Derrick Henry running. What they don't realize is that the result of those openings that Derrick Henry had was because teams were playing the Titans expecting to see Ryan Tannehill do what he did in the regular season. Having that balance, that 1-2 punch, is a great thing for any team, and it's proving as such for the Titans.
It's a decent receiving core as well. Corey Davis in the mix as well, and Jonnu Smith at tight end is kicking on. And, of course, an extra challenge now facing this well-oiled Titans offense.
Really? Yeah.
Missing Taylor Lewan, that's going to be a blow for them, but a big challenge for the Steelers, not just in this game, for the rest of the season, with Devin Bush out, who's the captain of their defense, isn't he?
Right, yeah, no doubt. And as you mentioned, Taylor Lewan, that's going to be an interesting one, left tackle, how they overcome that. But look, this Titans team has overcome a lot. I mean, think about what they've gone through with COVID. basically their situation. They're pretty much the hardest hit team in the NFL when it comes to having to deal with no practices. And they've ripped off two consecutive wins as a result. So it seems like the type of team that is not just dependent on one or two players, but rather dependent on sort of the culture that they're sort of building there.
In terms of how the Steelers approach this, particularly with the absence of Bush as well, because as Henry demonstrated in completely against Houston, but prior to that, he had had an interesting season because he was prolific in terms of overall yardage and certainly scoring, but his yards per carry had been quite limited in a number of games. And that didn't seem to offset or impact this offensive game plan at all of the Titans. So even if you can contain Henry to a respectable yards per carry, they will still get enough productivity out of him. And to your point, have enough elsewhere in this offense. How do the Steelers approach the Titans? What do you think are the keys to at least stifling this offense?
Well, you know, clearly we haven't seen a team do it well to date, given the fact that they're undefeated. But I just think that, you know, it'll be interesting if you can apply enough pressure to Tannehill. The difficult part about Tannehill is that, like, what's made this team so effective is the fact that he is a much more mobile quarterback than I think people give him credit for.
Right.
One of the best runners in the NFL at the quarterback position. So the tough part about it is, and I'm not really answering your question because it's a difficult one, is that the second that you think you can contain Derrick Henry, and the second you think if we can get enough pressure on Tannehill and force him sort of into the pocket and make those decisions, he'll just roll out with some play action and beat you with his legs. So to answer the question, I don't really know. I'm not sitting here saying that the Titans are some juggernaut. I just think that they present enough challenges that they can do different things. I mean, what's really impressive about them, it's kind of like what we saw from the Chiefs this week. You know, the Chiefs are obviously so good at the passing game, right? Mahomes is incredible. He's got these weapons. But all of a sudden, they're seeing these looks and they're saying, oh, you're going to try to take away the passing game? Watch what we can do with our running game.
It's a great point.
Just give it to Edwards-Helaire the entire game. I think that the Titans are just as capable of doing that as the Chiefs, which is obviously a pretty high standard.
It's a great point. You look at how the Bills were playing that. They were just all rocking back into coverage and getting absolutely burned. And now, of course, the Chiefs adding Lev Bell will just accelerate that play if they want to do it. I was working earlier on today with OCU Manura, who, of course, you will know well, and is a big figure in the NFL UK scene these days. And we were doing a show together, and he explained how the Chiefs beat the Bills as death by a thousand cuts.
which is a different way. Normally it's, you know, death by one freaking...
one knockout blow.
Exactly right. Which, by the way, what that does and what the Titans have been successful doing is putting that on tape for other teams to say, well, damn, what are we going to do now if they do this to us? You know, so having that counterbalance not only hurts a team in game, but it also hurts in their preparations because you have to spend time potentially defending everything, not just one thing.
Big time. This one line on this Steelers D, Devin Bush's absence notwithstanding, very good against the rush for the majority of the season, 66.2 rushing yards per game.
Very good,
and also locking down the play action as well as a result. And of course, those two things are obviously connected, right? But in terms of play action defense, they're allowing the lowest quarterback rating and completion rate since the start of the season, and we know they love to bring the pain as well. They love to blitz, so that's going to be, minus Luan, a really interesting battle, isn't it?
That's a good recipe, especially with what I was talking about, because I really do think that that Ryan Tannehill thrives with that play action. I've always felt like he's been so effective when he allows himself to freelance. Sometimes if he gets too robotic in the pocket, I think that's when he starts to struggle. But when he uses his athleticism, that's when he's most dangerous. So if the Steelers can kind of, you know, stifle that a little bit, that could go a long way.
Okay, let's move on to Bucks Raiders. Another standout game, I think, this weekend. Vegas off a bye week, of course.
Right.
And the Bucks off the back of smashing the Packers. It was a masterful performance, overall game plan really from Todd Bowles, wasn't it, against Aaron Rodgers. When you look at how he was deceiving him on quite a few occasions, it takes a lot to confuse a veteran quarterback. It takes even more to confuse one of the best quarterbacks of his generation who has seen it all. But there were definitely on the pick six, arguably on both picks really, Rodgers was confused by what he was seeing. He thought, is this cover two? Is it cover three? It was brilliant from Bowles. And for the first time this season, Rodgers has been unsettled and look rattled.
It's a good point. And it didn't necessarily seem like he was rattled because of the constant pressure. I mean, yes, at times the Bucs got to him, as Ndamukong Suh did at the end of the first half. But in general, it actually, to your point, felt like it was more the looks that he was getting that confused him, which is so rare for Aaron Rodgers.
Right.
Really great performance. The type that, you know, Todd Bowles, he keeps putting those together. Man, this defense, first of all, is hugely successful, but he'll be a guy that starts to get mentioned as a head coaching candidate again. But how much that helps to the offense of the Bucs to be able to come out there and make those plays. That pick six changed the whole momentum of that game. So to that point, what a scary proposition, a Tom Brady led team that can actually count on his defense to be a championship caliber squad. That kind of reminds you of the Patriots of the early 2000s. And we know exactly what happened with them.
Well, that story ended exactly. How does this Raiders offense match up with the Bucs D then? I mean, can its line handle the pass rush, for example? Because Tampa tied second in the league with 22 sacks on the year. Carr's been sacked 8 times so far this year. So not horrendous, not incredible protection there. So that's going to be quite a key battle. If we all know, like most quarterbacks, most mortal quarterbacks anyway, that Derek Carr, twice the player without pressure as opposed to with pressure, right? So can the line hold up?
Yeah, and exactly. And as we pointed out, that Todd Bowles is good at creating those kind of mismatches. Now, the question too, by the way, I think the Raiders offensive line had been sent home because of some COVID issues as well. So if they can't get the full preparation, it could make for an even a bigger challenge given the confidence of the Bucs defense right now. So I think that is a potentially tough mismatch. And to your point, I'm not saying that the Bucs will play as well as they did against the Packers every week. We've seen them struggle at times this season, but if they have half the performance against Derek Carr that they had against Aaron Rodgers, like to me, that just puts, again, you put the ball in Tom Brady's hands. And to that point, one other point we should make here, the fact that the Bucs were able to, they were the most penalized team in the NFL coming into this game, and then literally didn't have a single penalty against them for just the second time in franchise history. I mean, that's an incredible turnaround. And if that team, I was saying it through 5 weeks of the season, the biggest problem the Bucs had was themselves. They kept shooting themselves in the foot with the penalties.
Right.
If they get rid of that and they can do that again against the Raiders, I mean, all of a sudden, this team is absolutely trending toward, winning the division, but also having a really, really big run in the postseason.
It's a really great point. And I guess I was thinking about this in a totally different situation and a totally different caliber of team, but with the Cowboys and looking at their turnover differential, like that levels itself out eventually, right?
And that's the thing. The Bucs also didn't turn the ball over. I mean, turnovers and penalties, and by the way, that's, you know, the one question I had about Tom Brady's potential patience with the Bucs was if those discipline issues continued to crop up, that's the stuff that Bill Belichick took care of so well with the Patriots.
Right.
And that's on coaching. If you create discipline within your culture and you don't have those penalties, and to your point about the Cowboys, like you can't have those turnovers, you can't have those penalties. And I'm not putting it all on coaching, but that starts in the middle of the week. Mm. And if you can go into a game and take that off of your quarterback's shoulders, for instance, it's going to be a lot easier for the offense to produce.
Great point. It's a great point. On Derek Carr, briefly, Gruden just doesn't seem sold on him, Jeff.
No, it never has.
Is that fair? I mean, Carr, like the Raiders, I guess, collectively, just seems to flatter to deceive, right?
And, you know, it's funny because I had heard, it always felt to me, talking to people, like, we all criticize Derek Carr, right? And the Raiders are kind of like, Yeah, maybe he is a mediocre quarterback, but he's our mediocre quarterback. It's like they're very protective of their mediocre quarterback. And you know, I think that Derek Carr is a talented guy, but to your point, it feels like the organization wants to support him and wants to see him succeed, but at the same time, you just never feel like they're quite fully committed to getting there. I don't know what it is. It just doesn't feel quite like the perfect marriage. It just, it feels more like a kind of, and it was really like, you know, a marriage that someone said, hey, you guys are together, make it work. And it just, they tried.
Like a blind date. It was a blind, we're basically saying,
exactly.
Yeah, Carr agreed in a blind date. The interesting thing I think about Gruden when he got the gig was, has he been out of the game too long, out of coaching too long? Because obviously we're company men, Jeff. You know, he was you know, a part of the ESPN galaxy. But that was a concern. And he seemed to knock that on the head pretty quickly. And it was, I think it was always a slightly fatuous argument anyway, right? Because he was covering the game in the detail that he was all across all the current personnel. You know, the idea that he was out of touch was misguided. The other big thing when he got the gig was it's a 10-year contract. It's a 10-year deal. He's a few years in now, into his third year, right? Mm-hmm. I think.
Yep.
How do you think it's projecting so far? Well, or is it absolutely on the fence right now?
So I think it's going well, and it actually brings us full circle to what we were talking about at the start with the idea of having that cohesiveness. Because when you have that 10-year contract guaranteed, like, you can make some bold decisions early and not, you know, face the wrath of them. You can see them through, and that's going to be the case for Gruden. So he can have conviction in his decisions with the safety net of knowing that he's going to get the chance to see what happens with them. So I think that in that case, when you have a guy, by the way, who did prove himself somewhere else, you stick with him, you know, you stick with him by design, you know, through that long contract. I think you see that come to fruition a little bit with the success that they're starting to have. So, you know, Gruden is not for the faint of heart. You know, he makes tough decisions and he doesn't sugarcoat much. So you do have to have some patience with that sort of a coaching plan. And you know, for the Raiders, it feels at least like they're starting to see some of the benefit of that.
I was talking to, on this show, I think it was the other day, with one of our guests about Gruden resembling more and more Tony D'Amato from Any Given Sunday. He's just kind of getting to that phase of his career now, which I love. Just seen it all, done it all, no nonsense.
I want to see the inches speech. I want to see the speech.
Gruden's inches speech. Or just telling when Pacino tells Jamie Foxx just to go out and play ball like he did as a kid. I can just see him say that to Carr in the playoffs this year.
Yeah, but then throwing a pick and then Gruden being like, you know what? That was a terrible idea. Go back to doing what you were doing before.
Yeah. One more on this game, and then we'll talk very briefly, Seattle, Arizona. I just want to ask you about Gronk, because a lot of headlines, of course, given the fact that he appeared in terms of production for the first time this season, scored, had five or six catches, and looked a little bit like the Gronk of old. But he's obviously never going to be like exactly like the Gronk of old. So what can his role in this offense be, do you think, this year?
Well, first of all, I had mentioned something, I don't know if it was on air on ESPN or maybe on Twitter or something about Gronk, and, you know, he wasn't quite seeing the production, but he still seemed like an effective player, but just wasn't quite where he needed to be. And I had a former NFL head coach text me unsolicited and be like, hey, I've been studying him and he's actually really effective in the blocking game. And I know that Bruce Arians has mentioned that, but sometimes it feels when a coach says that you're just trying to protect your tight end's confidence. But this guy said, no, he has been actually very effective, which is a little bit of a different role for him because we're so used to seeing the Gronk spike and the touchdowns. That being said, it was nice to see him in this game get some confidence. And I think I think that's by design. You know, Brady throwing a couple balls up to him and say, go get him. And he did. Mm. The one difference that I think that they maybe are working through is the speed. It feels like Gronk is lumbering a little bit. I'm not saying he's ever been 4.240 kind of speed, but it does feel like he's not quite as fast as he once was. Mm. And as such, they're adjusting to it. And if you, I think what you saw in this game was let him get to where he needs to go and just let him go up and grab it.
Yeah.
Because that hasn't changed. His physicality hasn't changed. So we saw that in this game with the five catches. Mm. I think we'll continue to see more of that as we move forward.
It's a really interesting point you raise, actually, when you look at which positions in the NFL in particular players can adapt as they get older and ultimately their athletic set changes in the same way that you see this in football, in you know, European football. You know, certain players lose pace and they have to readjust, or someone like Ronaldo is a good example of that, who essentially redefined himself as an out-and-out striker as opposed to you know, a winger cutting in, and Pirlo, midfielder, same kind of thing, just dropped deeper and deeper. He didn't have the physicality to necessarily play the game he used to play, but just dropped deeper and was, and is actually often referred to as a quarterback, just pinging the ball around, even though he's lost a bit of edge.
You know, what's funny is we were talking about another quarterback in Ben Roethlisberger, the Steelers game. I saw some stats about Ben that he actually has the shortest yards per throw average that he's ever had in his career, and his release is much faster. And he, you know, he's coming off the elbow surgery, and he essentially said, "Yeah, like I recognize that I have to change my game." We're used to seeing Ben take the risks downfield, but more and more, he's just doing these short passes, redefining himself.
Interesting.
Same way that maybe we see from Gronk. You know, you take advantage of your cerebral experience in the game, and maybe say, okay, I can't do this as well over here, but now I know the game so much better, so I can do this over here.
Yeah, it's a really good point. One more for you. Seattle, Arizona. Very quickly, the Arizona Cowboys scoreline maybe painted a slightly deceptive picture about where this Arizona team is, in particular this offense is, right? Because, of course, three scores came off of turnovers. We talked about Dallas just coughing up the ball left, right, and center. And Kyler obviously had some explosive moments like the 80 Kirk, but didn't throw the ball all that much at all, and when he was, wasn't wildly accurate with it.
Yeah, I can't figure this one out. Right. I'm actually going to be at this game, and I don't know about Arizona. I get it. Like, you watch those, to your point, the explosive plays of Kyler, you see the potential. I just like can't quite buy in yet, and not saying he won't get there. It just, by all means, he has the weaponry to kind of the skill set to do it. Mm. But it just feels like it's not quite there. And by the way, when you're not quite there yet, when you're still developing that chemistry, you tend to do rely on what you can do best, which is run the ball and make explosive plays. So credit to them. You know, they kind of feel like a teenager where they're just sort of getting their legs under them. And they're just doing what they can do best while they figure out the rest of it. So if they can get wins, and they seem to be improving in that capacity until they can figure the rest out, I guess that's a good thing. But against a well-oiled machine like Seattle, I just don't think that he would have to really emerge in a different way than we saw against the Cowboys for me to believe that he's going to have a chance of beating them.
Seattle have got Jamal Adams back, to be back. They need him, right? Because despite the fact they've obviously collectively had a strong start to the season, defensively there are obvious flaws here as well. So Jamal Adams and his progression within this unit, integral to their ultimate success, isn't he?
It felt like that's the reason, you know, I mean, you don't give up as much as they gave up to get a player if you don't, A, recognize that you are a championship caliber team, and B, that you're missing something to get there. And so getting him back is exactly, you know, it puts them back to where they felt, you know, they recognize their deficiencies in the offseason. This puts them back in the spot where, you know, they can get to that full strength mode. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's huge. It's monumental. The most important thing, I think, for the Seahawks in a really tough division, mind you, it's not easy to get to the playoffs, but it will be having those guys healthy for that final stretch down the season, more so, I think, than right now.
Yeah. The Seahawks off a bye, of course. Where is Pete Carroll in your power rankings in the NFL of coaches off a bye? I mean, Belichick's got to be number one, right? Andy Reid's got to be up there.
Andy Reid. I think that he had maybe a couple losses recently off a bye.
Okay.
But in general, he was like unbelievable for years. He never lost. Pete Carroll too. You know what? I think a player told me that played for Andy Reid. He told me that why he thought that Andy was so successful after a bye. He sends everybody home. He gives them a break. He doesn't pound. Like, it's not like he says, oh, we have an extra week. We're going to prepare even more. And that's why we're so good. It's actually the opposite. He's like, you know what, guys, go get your rest, go get some fresh legs and come back. And Pete Carroll also seems like that kind of guy, you know,
right.
Like, he's been around long enough to recognize the benefit of rest. So anytime you have a veteran head coach who's got Super Bowls on his resume, I generally think that they're best after a bye because they just don't, they don't overthink it.
Bit more chilled. It's supposed to get him, you know, running up hills and chopping wood in the snow like Rocky IV or something. Yeah. That's what they experience. So do you think this is Seahawks' fairly straightforward win?
I do. You know, again, I maybe I'm sleeping on Arizona because I haven't watched them enough. But I from what I have seen, I just don't think that they're quite there. And by the way, it's such a tough division. I mean, you know, you put the Rams, I would have like when you look at the Rams, the 49ers, the Seahawks and the Cardinals, like you have the Seahawks up top. You had the Rams probably second, if not one. And then all of a sudden the 49ers throw that into the flux and beat the Rams. So, you know, as much as I'm inclined, I would have been inclined to say that the Rams would roll the 49ers last week. So it's a tough division and these division games can go either way. That said, my inclination is to say that, yeah, Seahawks will handle them.
The Seahawks keep it rolling. As you have as well, Jeff, another fine performance on the show. Really appreciate your time, man.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you guys. Thanks a lot.
Check it soon.
We'll talk soon.
Lovely stuff from Jeff. We will be checking in with him very, very soon. Appreciate his insight, his smarts. Really, really good stuff as ever. Let's move things quickly along. Delighted to welcome our next guest to the show. She's one of the key parts of Sky Sports NFL coverage. She has a brand new show on the Sky NFL channel that I'm sure she'll tell us all about. And we'll get into some of the big stories from the last few days in the NFL with her. Hannah Wilkes, making her debut. She's the host of the brand new show on Sky Sports NFL Overtime. Welcome to our show, Hannah Wilkes.
Thanks, Nat. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be with you via video, at least.
Yeah, we're making it work. You know what? I mean, I was thinking about this because obviously this is the first time we've had you on this show. We had a few beers at the Atlanta Super Bowl, I think, right? After we saw the Around the NFL live gig. But most of the time when we see each other, we are rushing around typically in opposite directions, like in the, you know, the bowels of a stadium on Radio Row with our, you know, respective crews, like hi, bye, zipping around. So it's good to actually get you on the show and finally be able to have a chat with you about football.
Absolutely. I was thinking, I was like, when did I last see Nat? And I think it was probably around this time last year, actually, because in a parallel universe, we'd be at Tottenham or Wembley, wouldn't we, this weekend, I think.
Right.
I mean, it was literally walking opposite directions through the bowels of the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Like, hey, you're right. Yeah, good. Yeah. And keep on moving. So, yeah, it's nice to actually chat to you properly.
There's a ton I want to get into. We're going to talk about some of the big news stories this week as well, because we've had Jeff Darlington on earlier and we were keen in on some of the big games. So I'm going to rattle through, if we have time, some rapid fire. We'll try and do together some rapid fire picks for some of the games a bit later on. But before we get to any of that, I want to talk about your new show, Overtime, right? So brand new Sky Sports NFL channel and a brand new show for you. If our listeners haven't seen it yet, tell us more about what they could expect.
If they haven't seen it yet, what on earth are they doing on Tuesday evenings? So every Tuesday at 9 on Sky Sports NFL, myself, Josh Denzel, and then it's been Rob Ryan. He'll be with us for a couple more weeks or, you know, someone else in the studio. So it's basically a highlights show, but it's much more than that. So we look back, we pick a couple of the big games of the week, and we bring you highlights of our kind of two game of the week picks. We bring you all the touchdowns from around the league, or at least the best ones, because there have been so many this year, we can't quite fit them all in. We bring you up to date with everything going on social media. So, you know, NFL players are all over it. So all the things you might have missed. Usually we've got some Cam Newton in a snazzy outfit. We've usually got some cool cleats from somewhere. But basically, whatever's been blowing up social media, we'll bring you up to date with. We also talk a fair bit of fantasy football, which I know everyone's always obsessed with their own lineup. And I have to remind myself, no one else cares who's on my team. They only care about their own. And we also speak to Kay Adams from Good Morning Football over on the NFL Network in New York. She joins us for her always stellar fantasy football tips. I think you're a fool if you don't tend to follow her advice, because she gets fantasy in a way that no one else can. So yeah, it's a really fun hour. We pack a lot into it. We also do pick'ems with mixed results. It's great fun, and it's a good way to sort of round up the week before we move on to the next one, because it's relentless, isn't it, NFL season?
Isn't it just, are you a decent fantasy player?
I'm in two leagues at the moment, and in one of them, I think I've only got one win, and on the other one, I've after three losses in a row, I'm making a bit of a resurgence. So it's really hit and miss, and I think it's impossible to be consistent, because you can have all the gut feelings in the world and feel like you're making all the right choices based on the matchups, but particularly with how things have gone this year, people come out of nowhere, results come out of nowhere. So it's so hard. I'm an enthusiastic player. I wouldn't say I'm the best at it, but it's fun, right? That's what it's all about. Adds a bit of extra drama, as if we need it, to all the games on a Sunday.
I wish I was a bit more disciplined with fantasy. I always end up, because the radio gig that I do, we normally start at 5 o'clock, and usually you can count on me at 4:57 thinking, reaching for my phone and setting my lineup. I need to focus a bit more, I think, is the moral of the story.
You do have to be disciplined. I've actually been away from my phone for a couple of hours this afternoon, and one of the leagues I play in, well, both leagues have got a WhatsApp group, but I came back to about 45 WhatsApps in one of the groups, and I was like, I can't, this is too much. But yeah, trade season is hotting up, that's for sure.
Big time. Hey, listen, before we get into some NFL news, the other thing I caught you on the other day on Sky was the Weber Cup coverage, right? 10-pin bowling. And I've got to ask, right, how tempted have you been being on, are you on set for it? I can't remember if you're there. Yeah, you are on set, right. To when everybody's done and the action's finished for the day, just to rock up with some of the crew and do your best Bill Murray.
Wow. Come on. You're actually the second person that's asked me that today. And that there is one major factor that kills any temptation for me to do that. And that is the fact that I am a shockingly bad bowler. And when you're around, you know, I think four of the guys competing are in like the top eight on the PBA tour out in the States. So there's a limit.
Unbelievable.
There's a limit to how much you want to embarrass yourself
in front of them. Just wait till they've all gone. Wait till they've all gone home. Put the bumpers up, Hannah. That's what I do.
This is the other problem. There are no bumpers, which I think is a shocking turn event. And also, the players bring their own balls. So once they go, the balls are gone. It's not like your local bowling alley where there's somewhere. They're all their own balls on the lane. So sadly, I have yet to make my maiden bowl on the Weber Cup lane. But it was a lot of fun. We're actually in a COVID secure bubble, so I feel like I've been released into the world. Now it's over. I went for a walk earlier. I was like, fresh air, daylight. But no, it's a lot of fun.
Get back. It looks a lot of fun, and it blew my mind watching just strike. How is this even possible? All right, let's get down to some NFL business then. So I want to talk about the Dolphin situation, because there are a number of things developing with this, not least Fitz's response to losing the starting gig. After we saw Tua coming in last week and getting a few snaps at the end of the game against the Jets in junk time, we saw Fitz on the sidelines, hyping up the crowd, just behaving in the way that we love Fitz, for just a team player, a charismatic character. And clearly at that point, he had no idea that this was quite probably going to be his last hurrah as a Finn, because 48 hours later, they announced Tua as their starter. Is this the right move, Hannah?
Oh, it's a complicated question, isn't it? And I have to say, when you look back at those celebrations from Fitz, and he was doing everything that a veteran quarterback is meant to do when he's got a rookie under his wing. He was his biggest cheerleader. And you can't help but think that moment is probably replaying over and over in his mind since they made that decision, that announcement. Right. Right? Just thinking, oh God, I was literally whooping for joy. It's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, we knew from early on last season that the Dolphins were going all out for Tua. Mm-hmm. And it feels rushed. It feels a little bit sudden in the way that it's happened, because he played, what, 2-3 snaps, like you say, in garbage time. He looked good, great, don't get me wrong. And now he's got the starting job. I suppose Brian Flores has always said that when the time is right, when he seems like the right guy, whoever's giving them the best chance of winning is going to be the guy. And they're 3-3. They're second in the AFC East behind the Bills, which is a position they haven't been in for a very long time. And the focus has got to be, right, at this point, okay, we've got ourselves a real chance here. We need to be getting to the playoffs. And Ryan Fitzpatrick, as much as we all love him, he hasn't made the postseason in 15 NFL seasons. And if you look at the stats, and they are saying this has got nothing to do with how he's performing, but he's thrown 10 touchdowns, 7 interceptions. Mm. That's not that's not a ratio that's going to potentially keep you going all the way through to January.
Right.
So it feels quite rushed, but then also, because I think just because it's so sudden from that couple of minutes on the field on Sunday to you've got the gig. But then you look at other teams and when they've had these first round draft picks and how they've utilized them, and you can't help thinking, is there ever a wrong time to start your the future, start the quarterback that you're hoping for big things from? You think, look what Lamar Jackson did back in 2018. Ravens were having a terrible season and then he turned it around for them and they made a playoff run when they started him.
Yep.
You think the Chiefs have been in a Super Bowl a year earlier if Patrick Mahomes hadn't been sat on the bench while Alex Smith played his first season. So, I mean, Brian Flores is entitled to make his decisions. He's always said that, you know, whoever is the best position to have them win,
yeah,
then he will. And he obviously thinks that that's Tua at the moment. He said he's been great in practice, looking comfortable. Of course, as well, don't forget, they've got a bye week this week, so he's got more time to prepare.
Best time to bring a rookie in, yeah.
It is, but also, you look at who they then play when they come back from that bye week and they're up against the Rams, which, take or leave what you think of the Rams out of it, he's going to start and he's going to be facing off with Aaron Donald.
Welcome
now,
to the NFL, right?
I know, right?
Like the Jets.
We saw how he welcomed Alex Smith back. What do you think he's going to try and do to Tua? I mean, Tua is definitely more mobile than Alex Smith. But, I mean, there's never, you know, there's always a too late point, I guess, to start your future. And for Dolphins fans, this is really exciting. And don't forget as well, there's no guarantee this is permanent for the rest of the season. If he has a few disastrous games, which hopefully he won't, we all want to see him perform. But if it doesn't work or it's not working, then Fitzpatrick is still there. He'll be back in. And I think been good to see from Fitz how he's already, despite talking about how heartbroken he is, also like, I have to put that aside and I have to be there and support him. He's got a lot of maturity in class, that man.
Well, on that, and I agree with everything you said, I think is spot on. I know the counter argument, and you mentioned it in passing with Mahomes and Andy Reid, and it's a great point you make, actually, because we were chatting about this earlier today. I was with OC and J-Bell, and I made the same point, because I'm a big fan of letting quarterbacks sit if you can, right? And normally it's a self-perpetuating cycle, right? If you are drafting a quarterback in the first round, early doors, certainly top 10, it's because your team isn't very good. Your team's probably not going to be immediately good next season. The fans want the new young quarterback in, right? And so I get that most of the time it's not possible, but the most obvious example is Aaron Rodgers under Favre, but also Mahomes under Andy Reid. And I was saying to Jay Bell and OC, why don't more teams do this? Why did the Dolphins, they're not serious playoff contenders. They can't really think they are, even in the East. Why didn't they just let him sit for two-thirds of the season, most of the season? On the one hand, as J-Bell was saying, well, you can only learn this gig by doing this gig. And there's a lot of validity in that. But as OC said, to your point on Mahomes and the Chiefs, we don't know. If he'd gone in a year earlier, he might have been straight away like that. Knowing Mahomes, he probably would have been, right? A lot of it's been said about him sitting under, learning from Alex Smith, and clearly that has been fundamental to his quick acclimatization to the NFL. But with a player of that caliber, and Tua is in that same, at that same level potentially, right? Then it's a great point you make. He could roll in. But Fitz, let's talk about that for a minute, because he is a class act. We love him. My favorite thing, the beard. Fitz scrambling for a first down is my favorite thing, I think, in maybe the history of sport, but definitely.
Wow, that's a big statement.
I basically got fired yesterday, and today my day consisted of Zoom meetings with the guy that fired me and sitting in a room with the guy who replaced me for 4 hours. Were you surprised, Hannah, that he, not surprised that he's annoyed with the situation, surprised that he didn't bite his tongue?
What do you mean by not making those comments?
Yeah, it puts a lot of pressure on Tua, and also it potentially divides the locker room a little bit, you know? He's a vet that's got a lot of friends in that locker room.
Yeah, I think you make an interesting point, and I have to admit, I hadn't thought of it that way. And I mean, the whole situation from those comments makes you realise just what an absurd, you know, setup NFL teams are in a lot of ways, because that would never happen in any other job, would it?
Right.
I think what we've got there from Fitz is just unfiltered honesty. It's almost like, given the situation, he can't hide his feelings because of what he's feeling. And this is a man that not that long ago, just a matter of weeks ago, lost his mum and didn't speak about it publicly, the effect that was having on him emotionally. So he's someone that, you know, can can keep it in. It's not like he needs to say everything, but I think that raw emotion, you can't hide it. You can't shy away from it. And also as well with the kind of character is, if he'd just come out and just given, especially after making those whoops and hollers and jumps on the sideline, if he came out and just was like, yep, right man, right time, fine. Mm-hmm. It would feel very disingenuous. And mm-hmm. I think we'd all be talking about it anyway. So yeah, I mean, it's like you say, it is surprising. I really hadn't looked at it like that, but I think that unfiltered honesty, I don't think it puts too much pressure on Tua. I think it's more of a dig at a sort of, you know, how the news came out, because this was circulating on Twitter well before it had been communicated to the players. And that is a gaffe on the part of Brian Flores. It has to be said, like, that is not okay. That the fact, I think it was Adam Schefter from ESPN was the one that was basically telling everyone that this was happening before, I imagine, Fitzpatrick had even had the conversation. So I think it's probably more of a thinly veiled barber, that side of it, than Tua, because, you know, we know how much of an effort he's made to make Tua feel welcome. He sort of FaceTimed him with his family to introduce them when he first got to Miami and all the rest of it. So
yeah,
I don't think it puts pressure on Tua. I think, you know, I think he'll really support him, and I think they obviously have fostered a relationship there. I think that's more a thanks for the way that was handled.
Appreciate that, guys. Thanks for that. Yeah. I would love to be the fly on the wall in that Zoom call. That would have been interesting. All right, let's talk Dallas. They have the Washington football team this weekend off the back of the 38-10 loss to Arizona, where they were shellacked. As we were talking about this with Jeff Darlington a bit earlier on, a slightly deceptive scoreline in a way, given how profligate they were, the ball, Dallas, and they have been all season long, just coughing it up left, right, and center. But clearly offensively, with Dalton in and Zeke not firing, they couldn't get anything going. It's a good bounce back opportunity against Washington. Despite some of the defensive pieces they have, of course, it is definitely one of the more favorable matchups you want to face if you want to try and get this train back on the track. However, this is the Dallas Cowboys we're talking about. Things going all the way, speaking of the train, to dysfunction Central Station, right? Because unattributed anonymous quotes coming out to NFL Network's James Slater, which are extraordinary, right? So they are, among other things, criticizing the coaches here, totally unprepared, Mike McCarthy's staff. They don't teach. They don't have any sense of adjusting on the fly. That's something I can relate to. they just aren't good at their jobs, another player told Slater. Mike Nolan, the defensive coordinator, of course, has got a lot of history with Mike McCarthy, and the suggestion is he's out of touch, he's out of his depth, it's jobs for the boys. And the fact the players have come out now and said this, albeit anonymously, what does this tell you about how much of a mess this Cowboys franchise is right now?
I mean, it tells you everything, really, doesn't it? Because, you know, locker rooms generally look after themselves. You don't tend to hear comments like this from players apart from when it is real crisis times. And I know sort of Mike McCarthy and the coaching staff have kind of said, I've seen some quotes knocking around today going, when it's an anonymous source, like, take it with a pinch of salt. You don't know whether that's someone that is even still in the locker room, and trying to play it down. But with Jane Slater's sort of immaculate reporting style, I struggle to believe they're coming from anyone that's not currently in the locker room.
100%.
Yeah, I think it just shows that they haven't got the belief system. It was always going to be hard for Mike McCarthy going in after so long under Jason Garrett and to sort of impose a style of play and perhaps a culture change there. I mean, it's obviously not working. And I think the response that he's kind of come out with about, no, we're going to continue to develop our program, committed to our system, it's all very surface level. But this is really concerning, because NFL players just don't do this. And I think these are sort of quite cutting remarks. And I don't think it's even just about the sort of defensive play calling as well. I think when you look at how the whole setup is working, in that you've got Mike McCarthy, who's this huge offensive coordinator with this massive background in play calling, he's not making any calls. He's, you know, he's relegated to nothing on the sideline as Kellen Moore continues to make the calls. So you wonder if there's frustration there. The adjustments don't seem to be happening as they play out these games. And I know you can kind of look and go, you know, their game between them and Atlanta, which is, you know, one of their wins, it could have so easily gone the other way. It all came down to that onside kick right at the end. It could have so easily, they so easily could be 1-5 this year. That's the fine margins we're talking about. And I think they've got all these playmakers there, not consistently making plays. And you've just got to say, well, why not? What is not working? And as great as Kellen Moore is, he makes great play calls, designs fantastic schemes, but there doesn't seem to be much consistency or logic. He doesn't look to adapt. And I think this is where it's coming from. He doesn't look to adapt to what the opposing defense is doing. He sticks to his playbook or of what he wants to do. And I think that frustration starts to creep up. And, you know, I mean, the way they are performing, they need to be making adjustments, and they clearly aren't making many. It really is sensational. It's the one NFL story, I think, this week, probably more so than the Tua thing, because I think eventually that was going to happen. Hear those comments and you kind of sit up and go, my goodness, they are in trouble there, and they need to turn this around. Losing Dak was bad. Losing the locker room is even worse.
Right. There's no coming back from the latter, absolutely. And maybe from the former, if Dalton can somehow get... Because you look at the caliber of backups in the NFL, and Dalton's got to be in your top three, right? Certainly for this kind of offense. So, but of course, it's all about giving him a bit of time, and that's where the line's banged up even more, right? So the another injury on the line means that the backup left tackle's gone out now. So, I mean, Washington, you know, and Chase Young and co are going to look at this, and Montez Sweat, who is a dangerous player, they're going to be looking at this and thinking, this could get quite interesting. It's a great point you make about Kellen Moore, and it's kind of Wenger-esque, right? We're going to beat you this way, and I don't care. We're not going to change
my things. My way.
Yeah,
you've got to think as well with the way they brought Mike McCarthy in, and Kellen Moore is still very much Jerry Jones's man, and you just wonder, is that something the players are hinting at as well? Just sort of, you know, is this current setup working? Should it have been a different head coach? I don't know. Hypothesizing.
It's a good theory. I think it's a tough gig hand though, because Jerry Jones has his fingers all over that team. It's such a visible presence and owner. I just don't think a really serious, credible head coach or coordinator wanting to make the step up is going to take that job. You know, I think Josh McDaniels, it's Dallas. It's an amazing gig. I think someone like Josh McDaniels, for example, right? Or Eric Bieniemy is going to look at that and think, there are easier landing spots. I mean, Belichick always talked about this around McDaniels when the Indianapolis Colts thing happened a few years back, when he got cold feet and backed off. Belichick has had this imprinted on him because of his coaching tree. It's tempting, but only go into the right situation. I don't think Dallas, despite their money and their power and the status of the team, I don't think at the moment it can be the right situation for most coaches.
And it's an interesting one as well, because when it was announced that it was going to be Mike McCarthy, you thought, okay, right, this is a different character. Is he going to be the guy that will kind of say to Jerry Jones, this isn't working, this is right, what needs to change? And that doesn't seem to have been the case at all. And you do wonder at what point Jerry Jones will start, if he ever will, I'm not sure he would, him adjusting how he does things, because, you know, they are the Dallas Cowboys. They have, you've still got the America's team banner, but the fact is that they haven't been to a Super Bowl for, what, 25 years? They haven't made an NFC championship game in a very long time. So it's like, at some point, you have to start making adjustments, because although you've got the talent there on the field when everyone's healthy, which obviously is not the case in this current moment, but you've got the talent on the field, you've still held on to this reputation and the allure of the Dallas Cowboys, but you need to be picking up more silverware and living up to that name. And you've got to think bigger. Where are these changes and these flexes going to come?
The craziest thing of all of this, and we've talked about some quite crazy things going on with Dallas, is they're still contenders for the playoffs, right? Because they're in the NFC East. So, I mean, they could quite conceivably win it with a 7-9 record.
It utterly blows my mind. The NFC East is just like this being that I can't quite wrap my head around how it continues year after year to be what it is. And I want to say no disrespect to the teams here, but come on. I mean, you look at the winning records, you look at the standings, and you think, yeah, Cowboys are 2-4 and they are in first place. And then you look, you know, across the NFC West and you look at that division, you think, okay, maybe we start mixing these up a bit, because yeah, they could very well still be a playoff team. I do think expanded playoff field this year kind of goes some way to sort of level it out a bit. But yeah, we need the NFC East to up its game. We really do. The rest of the NFC is firing on all cylinders this season, so they're letting us lie down.
It's textbook NFL, right? Because you know, back when I was starting out, the NFC East was the powerhouse. It was, you know, I mean, those giant Super Bowl teams, the Eagles under Andy Reid were always contenders. The Cowboys obviously were for most of the time, and now it is full circle. We are pushed for time, unfortunately, which is a shame because we've gotten to a ton of stuff. But I'm going to do one more for the road. And we'd love to have you back and get into more football chat later on in the season, if that worked for you. One for the road. Okay, we got the Jets, Bills, and then Lions, Atlanta. Which head coach is more likely to get the bullet first this season, do you think? Adam Gase of the Jets or Matt Patricia of the Lions?
This is an interesting one. My gut reaction is Adam Gase. I think the Lions, although they are 2-3 at the moment, I think you see flashes, and we saw it last year as well. You see some flashes of great play and reasons to be positive. Adam Gase. I just think the Jets are the only team to still not register a win through 6 weeks of this season. There doesn't seem to have been much progression from one year to the next. Poor Sam Darnold is obviously out at the moment, but you just think, what is he actually capable of? We just don't know. Mm. I've just seen the fallout of with him and Lev Bell leaving. And again, it was similar to the Cowboys situation. You kind of go, has he got this locker room on side here? Or is it too much of a hole for them to climb out of? Yeah, I think, like I said, I think Lions, there are some shoots of positivity occasionally. They're a bit few and far between. But I think as well, I think in Detroit, they're possibly a bit more forgiving and they'll give him a little bit longer. Whereas I do feel like Adam Gase's days are numbered in New York.
Yeah, I mean, quite conceivably, could go 0-16 as well. The Jets, it would be just, they are one of the worst teams I think I've ever seen since I've been covering the, I mean, they really are, aren't they? They're just, I mean,
I have to say, I don't watch much of them. I think because there's no point, really. And that sounds so hard. I watch the odd play when Sam Darnold does a bit of magic and gets himself out of trouble. And, you know, having watched the Dolphins game for the Dolphins side of things this week, watch them that way. But they're not a team you actively seek out to watch because there's just nothing exciting. I mean, they're completely shut out against the Dolphins this week. Like, I think it was the fourth quarter perhaps before they even made a third down. Like, it's painful.
It's tough if you are a Jets fan. I sympathize. Just forget what's going on now. Just deep dive into the past. Look, dig up some Joe Namath goodness, because it's a bit like, as a West Ham fan, I always, all the things are going all right at the moment, but I will always look back to Bobby Moore in times of need. That's what Jets fans need to do. Just put Joe Namath up there and you'll be fine. You will get goodness out of that. Was that a tip of that? Are you a Dolphins fan?
No, I'm not at all, actually.
Do you have a team?
I'm a Rams fan.
You're a Rams.
Yeah, so I miss the glory days of 2018. Although I can't figure out where we sit this year. I did feel sort of build up to the start of the season. I was getting really aggrieved that we were getting consistently written off, ignored, all this talk of a rebuild. And I'm like, look at this roster and look at this coaching staff. You can't write this team off. And there have been a couple of questionable performances. I mean, it wasn't great against the 49ers. When Jared Goff has a bad day, he does have a bad day. And I know everyone's going to go instantly, well, they've played the NFC East, and obviously with what I've just said about that, fair point to an extent, but you can only play the schedule you've got, right?
Right.
I had my moments of concern at the start of the season, measured with this, everyone's writing us off, and I don't think we're going to be that bad. So I think it could be okay. I reckon playoffs this year, for sure.
I think there are both Gregs on our show. So Rosenthal, who of course is part of your coverage as well, Greg Brady, both big on the Rams this season. Greg was on our show on Monday, despite the 49ers loss, was saying they're a definite playoff team. Greg Rosenthal preseason was telling us definite playoff team. So yeah. That is high praise indeed from those two. They are good football minds, so you can be confident about it. Were you an LA Rams fan, St. Louis Rams fan, original LA Rams fan?
So I came to the NFL relatively, I want to say late in life, but that makes me sound older than I am. I'm not that old. I'm oldish. Anyway, so when I started watching the NFL about 10 years ago, 9 years ago, really. When I started working at Sky, actually, as a runner, I didn't grow up in an NFL household, really hadn't seen much of it. I mean, it was working on it that got me into it. So then it's like, okay, well, who am I going to support really? And for years, I sort of dipped in and out of it. And I kind of was trying to pick a team. Nothing felt quite right. And then it was around the time the Rams were moving from St. Louis to LA. And they did the All or Nothing documentary. And I watched all of it. Yeah. And I think when you haven't grown up with a sport, you need something that makes you feel connected to the people playing it. And yeah, so I was watching that. And they were coming to London that year as well. So I was going to watch them play.
Was that Goff's first season? Was that, is that right? Was he, was yeah. he, yeah, when he's a rookie in it?
Yeah, I think they played at Twickenham. Did they play Twickenham that year, I think? Or was that the year after?
Because I think at Hard Knocks when he, was it on Hard Knocks as well? Or anyway, yeah, so, because I remember Goff's first season, there was some, I'm sure our listeners will fire this out at the NC show if you remember this, but Goff, they wound him up at a sunset or he couldn't believe it. Yeah.
Right? He didn't know whether the sun rose in the east or west consistently.
Amazing. Which
I have to say, I feel has harmed him and how people perceive him in terms of intelligence level ever since. I think, I can't remember whether it was Hard Knocks or All or Nothing. I think it was All or Nothing.
Either way,
it was one of those very good. So anyway, that's how I sort of got into supporting the Rams, and I've seen them play more than any other team as well by this point. So in real life. So yeah, and also you kind of. It's a strange one, isn't it? Every kind of other team I thought about, mate, just didn't quite fit. So
they connected. It's a good pick. You've chosen wisely, Hannah. You've chosen wisely. Listen, congratulations on the Overtime Show. Give that one more plug. So Tuesday nights?
Tuesday nights, 9 p.m. on Sky Sports NFL, which is surely the only channel that your listeners ever have on their TV anyway these days.
You are talking to an ESPN show, but we share the love. We share the love, of course. We do.
In the UK, I mean.
There you go. It's great to catch up with you, finally. Do come back and see us soon.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Hannah. Take care. Lovely stuff from Hannah. Looking forward to checking in with her soon. Go check out the show Overtime on Sky Sports NFL. Saluting Jeff from across the pond as well. Ditto, Marley, Tom, Andy on our social channels at the NC Show, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. If you haven't already, incidentally, spend 10, 15, maybe even 25 seconds leaving us a review on whichever platform you listen to, because hey, it works in terms of spreading the word of the show, helps us with the worldwide leader, helps us with our sponsors, and most importantly of all, puts a big smile on the faces of Harry and Ollie, and that makes me a happy man. Get behind us if you can. We would massively appreciate that. We're back Monday, looking back at what I guarantee is going to be another whirlwind Sunday of NFL action. We'll see you then. Bye for now, guys.